It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about one woman's experience working as a physical therapist in Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
But first, a federal government study published yesterday in the journal Nature Climate Change concludes that biofuels made with corn residue release 7% more greenhouse gases in the short term compared with conventional gasoline. With us is Michael Kraft, a professor emeritus of public and environmental affairs at the UW-Green Bay, to explain what the study means for the environment and for the future of biofuels. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'd like to start by getting some background on this particular study and more specifically what they were studying. When a lot of people hear the word corn and biofuels, they automatically think of ethanol. But we're talking about something else here, aren't we?
Right. We're talking not about the corn kernels per se, but the leftovers, that is the stalk of the corn plant. And much depends in these kinds of studies on just how much of the residue is used. And I think for those who disagree with the study, that is one of the points of contention. So let's distinguish corn-based ethanol from the corn residue-based ethanol. And so this is the study is about what is called cellulosic ethanol, and that cellulosic refers to the woody parts of trees, and whether it's wood residue and from forestry operations or corn or other crops, that's a very different kind of conversion process than using corn itself.
And this is what we heard about, during the Bush administration when he was talking about switchgrass and things
that.
Same sort of thing.
And the hope is over time that you do not use corn or any other food crop. Now, I think the figures are still accurate that something like 40% of the U.S. corn crop is used for ethanol production. And that has driven up the prices of corn and other food around the world. So the reason to pursue cellulosic-based ethanol rather than corn-based is to not use food crops but try something else. So the reason why the study is important is it's not worth doing any of this if it produces no benefit in terms of reduced greenhouse gases compared to gasoline. And that's the focus of the study. They said it did not produce a lowering of greenhouse gases beyond burning regular gasoline. And if that finding is upheld in later studies, that would mean cellulosic ethanol would not meet the current EPA standard for renewable biofuels and obviously would not be doing much to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States or anywhere else.
Now, have you had a chance to take a look at the study? And if so, what do you think?
Yeah. I've looked at summaries of the study, not the study per se, and then we can get, I'm a political scientist, not a biochemist or an ecologist. But what I saw is, first of all, you mentioned this is a federal government study, but it wasn't done by the federal government. It was done by an assistant professor of biological systems engineering at the University of Nebraska. And the EPA itself says its own analysis was different from the assumptions made in that study. And I see in one AP release, an EPA spokesperson said that the study we're talking about, quote, does not provide useful information relevant to the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from corn stover ethanol, meaning corn residue. There's a comparison in this press release to a peer-reviewed study that the Department of Energy itself did 2 years ago, which found that biofuels made with corn residue were, in fact, 95% better than gasoline. Now, on the other side, David Tillman, who's a very widely regarded ecologist at the University of Minnesota, says this study suggests it will be very hard to make a biofuel that has a better greenhouse gas impact than gasoline. He says it's the best study he's seen so far. So what I conclude from that is, as is true of many academic studies, the conclusion depends on how the study is designed. For any energy source, you need a very complete, what we call, life cycle analysis. And if you make different assumptions than, for example, the Department of Energy or EPA does, you might well come to different conclusions. So my draw from this is we ought to do some more studies. We ought to be sure before we commit the nation to using cellulosic-based ethanol, or for that matter, corn-based ethanol, that it makes sense. That is, that it really does reduce greenhouse gases and is economically viable. Otherwise, there's no point in doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for people who follow biofuels and the debate over that. This just adds, I guess, more murkiness to the whole thing. It seems as though we get conflicting studies and have been getting in conflicting studies.
Yeah, we get conflicting studies everywhere. We do it on healthcare, on, you know, on food safety, on the outcomes of different medical procedures, on school voucher programs, and what. This is the nature of science. And so this is the first major study that apparently has thoroughly examined the issue. There will be other studies. In the meantime, the country still has a national policy, which Congress approved in 2007, which set up this renewable fuel standard, which says we ought to be relying more on renewable fuels. And this was done in part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also in part to reduce oil imports to the United States. Now, the oil imports have gone way down. Since President Obama took office, we've gone from 60% all the way down to what this year is estimated to be only 30%. But that's not so much from using ethanol as from increased oil and gas production in the United States and better fuel economy in U.S. cars and trucks. Still, biofuels are very important for the future. Cellulosic ethanol is only one way to do this. There are all kinds of experiments underway using algae, for example, to directly produce biofuel. And I think this is an exciting time. In the next 5 or 10 years, we'll find ways to make fuel for our cars and other purposes that is not derived from oil, namely gasoline, or is not necessarily derived from a food crop. So this is... we're early in that process, and this is one study. Looks like it's a pretty good one. Does raise some questions. EPA says they don't agree with it. DuPont, which is heavily invested in biofuels, says they don't think it was a good study either. And that's not so unusual in studies in many different fields, as I mentioned. So we'll go from here.
Yeah, but as you say, the situation energy-wise has really changed since 2007, and oil production all of a sudden is a factor here in the U.S. and that it wasn't. Does that take a lot of that pressure off that we saw back in 2007 to come up with something to replace oil?
Yeah, it does. But Congress was motivated at that time mainly by heavy U.S. reliance on imported oil. Now there's a different factor. I think, as most of your listeners know, this has been a year we've had three major reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the latest one coming just a short time ago. And all of these lead to increased concern about greenhouse gas emissions, mostly based on use of fossil fuels. There's a little bit of one cause is deforestation, but mostly it's because we use coal, oil, and natural gas. We and most other countries in the world, and that simply has to change. And it has to change soon, in the next 10 to 15 years, the IPCC says. So I would say that means an intensive period of investigation of different kinds of energy technologies, and biofuels would be one of those. And we'll, you know, we go from there. We have to be sure that there's a payoff to what we're doing. But it's a little hard to tell from the present research.
So if it's not cellulosic biofuels, what other kind of biofuels do you think right now hold some promise as far as being viable in the future?
Well, again, it's hard for me. I'm not an expert in biofuels to speak to that. But I've read quite a few articles in various newspapers and journals that suggest there's a lot of promise in algae-based biofuel production. There are a lot of companies getting heavy investment from Silicon Valley venture capitalists to try to find something there. We're still very much early in this whole process. From my perspective, and I think this is what the Department of Energy at the federal level has done, is to invest heavily in cutting-edge research to find answers, just like this study produced, which is what works and what doesn't work, what is promising. How do we design better studies so we can chart a clearer path to the future? And at this point, as President Obama is fond of saying, it's all of the above. That is, we need to use a variety of energy sources, but we also need to start moving away, and to do it soon, from fossil fuels to alternatives. And any path we find that's going to be productive in that sense is worth looking at. And biofuels hold a great deal of promise. I don't think the study says that's the end of biofuels. It does suggest some caution about moving quickly toward certain ways of using cellulosic-based ethanol.
And it sounds as though you're also saying that this is not the definitive study that people should hang their hat on, that there doesn't...
Well, what I'm saying is the news releases I've seen show that the EPA and DuPont and other people who have looked very carefully at cellulosic ethanol express doubts about this study being the definitive study. And that's not unusual in the way scientific research goes. But it tells me just because one study, even though it was a pretty good one, finds that it's not better than gasoline, that's not the last word on the subject.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at the UW-Green Bay. What our next guest wanted was a decent job with normal hours, but what she got was anything but that. For years, Adele Levine was a physical therapist inside the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, which treated soldiers throughout the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan before it was closed in 2011.
And that meant treating young military personnel with debilitating combat injuries, both physically and emotionally. While the experience for her, her colleagues, and her patients was often intense, consuming, and heartbreaking, she says the atmosphere there was also filled with incredible camaraderie and, in some cases, unlikely comedy. In a new book, she details the story of her time at Walter Reed and shows a side of war not often seen.
Adele Levine is the author of Run, Don't Walk, The Curious and Chaotic Life of a Physical Therapist Inside Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Adele, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, the first question I have for you is the obvious one. Why was this a book that needed to be written? Why did you feel the need, after your time there, to do more than just walk away with some good stories that you could tell to your friends and family?
Oh, I felt that the history of Walter Reed was a really important part of American history, and I wanted to, I didn't just want to see those gates closed without people knowing what happened while we were there. You know, Walter Reed was America's oldest Army hospital. It treated soldiers from every single major war we were in, from World War I forward, and I sort of thought it was, you know, kind of incredible that I was there, and, you know, here we were. We were sort of the last chapter, and I don't know, I didn't want to forget it just for myself personally, and I wanted to create a snapshot in time.
So tell me about your path to Walter Reed. As a physical therapist, you could have gone any number of places. Why there?
I had moved into an apartment across the street, and I was signing the lease, and my landlord knew I was a physical therapist, and she just assumed I was working at Walter Reed. She pointed it out to me, and she was like, "Oh, so you're working over there, right?" And I was like, "No, you know, but I probably should."
And so you literally walked across the street, and one thing led to another?
Well, I sent my resume in.
Sure.
And it didn't happen right away, and actually by the time I started working there, I had a bad flood in my apartment, and I lost my nice basement apartment. I had to move out.
But you still got to come back and work across the street.
Yeah, I did.
So at the time, Walter Reed, as you mentioned, had a storied history. At the same time in the 2000s, and I think around 2007 or so, it also had some pretty significant challenges in terms of funding. There were, I think, some neglect cases there and so on. So it was really kind of a mixed bag. You had a lot of great legacy there, but a lot of challenges at the same time.
Well, you know, I worked in the amputee clinic. But you have to keep in mind that Walter Reed was also, in a way, also a large workman's comp facility. And they processed many, many soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, many of whom, you know, wanted to stay there because while they were there, they got premium pay or whatever. So there was, you know, there were people who were had things to gain by certain stories. You might want to look into the patients that they featured in those stories. You know, I can't speak to it. I'm not an administrator, so but I can say that I thought that the care that we gave at Walter Reed was incredible. I remember having a bad kidney stone and just wishing I could have been treated at Walter Reed.
So when you went to work at Walter Reed, as you mentioned, you worked a lot with amputees. And was that assigned to you, or was that an area that you chose to explore?
Oh, I didn't choose it. When I first started working at Walter Reed in 2005, I was in the outpatient clinic, and that was really where I wanted to be. And I did that for about 2.5 years, and I was starting to feel kind of burnt out. And, you know, I went to talk to the colonel, and I told her I was feeling, you know, really kind of run down, and I thought that maybe I would apply for another job. And she told me to take a couple. She told me to take a week off of work, and go downtown and do like a staycation. And you know, we're in D.C., so she told me I should go to all the museums. And I thought she was just crazy, you know. But you know, so I took the week off, and I went and I saw all the museums, and then I came back to work on Monday, and she pulled me into her office, and she just said she was moving me into the amputee section.
And there you go. And in that section, you met a lot of people that stayed with you and wound up in this book. And a lot of them, of course, very young soldiers, a lot of them maybe in their early 20s, coming home with severe injuries and emotional distress as well. And the one, maybe a good example of it, is this young man named, nicknamed, I guess, Cosmo. And he used a particular word that we cannot use here on public radio, but his vocabulary was somewhat limited, but it's a terrific story, and I'm wondering if you'd share that.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, straight up, Cosmo was made up of three patients that I saw, and there was a Cosmo that I treated in the ICU, and then one in the outpatient clinic, and later one at the end of the book who decided to amputate his second leg. You know, when you're a physical therapist, you see hundreds and hundreds of patients, you know, and hopefully you have a long career. And after a while, you get really good at recognizing certain personalities. And I just felt like, you know, at Walter Reed, we had, you know, there are many, many stories out there about people overcoming difficult situations and triumphing. But I felt that it was also important to share a story of someone who isn't necessarily triumphing at the time because they're kind of stuck with where they are now. And I felt like Cosmo, and again, I work in a hospital, so I have to protect patient privacy. The three men that made up Cosmo really fit that bill. You know, they were having a hard time, and a lot of their difficulties were just within themselves. They were going to do what they were going to do, and they sure weren't going to listen to me. And they were angry in a way, and also they had a lot of spunk. You know, most of the injuries that we saw early in the wars were single-leg amputees, and, you know, Cosmo was a single-leg amputee when he came into the hospital, but he had very typical injuries of a Walter Reed patient in that the other leg was completely destroyed, and that was the leg that they would refer to as the intact leg in the medical chart, and his intact leg was really shattered in many pieces, probably 8 pieces. He had what they call external fixators, which are kind of like metal cages or scaffolding that goes around the leg and has pins that go into the bone and hold the broken pieces together. And you would see back then at Walter Reed, you would see many, many patients who had one amputation and then the other leg was sort of encased in these external fixators. And, you know, it was funny. Well, it wasn't funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it was the intact leg, that shattered leg, that usually gave them the most grief. Later on, many of them chose to have that other side amputated just because they had such difficulty with it. As the wars went on, we saw fewer and fewer patients with an intact leg because, you know, by 2010, 2011, most of our patients coming back were missing both of their legs. But at that time in 2009, when Cosmo came in, he had one leg and he had one amputated leg and the other one was encased in scaffolding to hold it together.
Now, in the minute or so that we have left, you know, the book that you wrote shows us a piece of war that a lot of people never really see. You see the headlines and you know, the coming home ceremonies, but you don't see this side of it. So keeping that in mind, what do you hope people take away from your story?
Well, a couple things. One is I think it's important for people to realize just how many people are behind the scenes in getting these young men and women, you know, back on their feet again. And it's often, you know, it's not just the medical staff, but I would say that, you know, everybody at Walter Reed really pitched in. There was a great deal of pride there. I mean, from the cafeteria lady who called everyone baby and sweetie to, you know, the people who worked in the gift shop. And also the patients and their families. It was a real team effort. And the other thing I would like to say is that I feel like, in a way, that my book is kind of a metaphor for this country at large, where, you know, we are going through a difficult time, and we were going through a difficult time back then, of course, at Walter Reed. But our clinic was kind of our microcosm of America. We had patients and family members and staff members from all over America and from many, many different backgrounds. And we could have let our differences...
And I'm afraid, Adele, that we're running out of time, but thanks so much for that. That was Adele Levine, the author of Run, Don't Walk, The Curious and Chaotic Life of a Physical Therapist Inside Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
We take a look at what are projected to be the best and worst jobs of 2014.
That's right. The website CareerCast has just come out with their annual list of the best and the worst jobs. And if you're in the STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, we've got some good news for you. However, if you are a lumberjacker, or even more ominously, if you are a broadcaster, the news isn't quite so rosy.
We've got Tony Lee with us, publisher of CareerCast. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your lists are always good conversation starters, maybe argument starters. There are a lot of ways to define a good and bad job. What's your criteria? What do you use to rank jobs?
Well, we've been doing this on CareerCast.com for many years, and we look at criteria. It's very data-driven. So we look at things like salary today and projected compensation in the future, hiring demand today and what it will be like, you know, moving forward, unemployment rates. And then we also look at things like physical demands. Is your life at risk? Is it a job that carries a lot of stress, perhaps a lot of travel, or are you sitting in a nice air-conditioned office managing your own schedule each day? So those are all the things we look at when we come up with our rankings.
So given all of that, are these job listings that change a lot dramatically from year to year, or is the change more incremental?
It tends to be more incremental. We look at the 200 jobs that are most populous in the United States. In other words, the jobs that most people, you know, have. There are thousands of jobs. And so we get data from places like the Bureau of Labor Statistics and OSHA and all sorts of different trade groups. And, you know, there are changes every year, but really not enough to make a dramatic change in what jobs are good and what jobs aren't so good.
Well, you've given me some ammunition talking to my kids about their math class. A lot of the top jobs are math-related, including number one, mathematician.
Yeah, and, you know, when they tell you that to pay attention in math class, in science class, it's really good to listen, especially if instead you're dreaming of becoming a taxi driver. So there's no question that this report shows, as it has in the past, if you have any skill at all towards math, science, in any of the related fields, then the likelihood of you having a career that's going to reward you well, both in terms of you know, being able to hold a job for a long time, get paid well for your job, be able to change jobs for, you know, an even higher level position, then it's going to be within the STEM careers.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that because the STEM fields, you've got the statistician, the actuary, software engineer. I mean, STEM, we've been hearing about that a lot in terms of education in the past 5-10 years or so. And now as you look at these figures, it's really a place to be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we hear back from a lot of teachers, both secondary and even down to the elementary level and middle school, who say, you know, I'd like to engage my students in a realistic discussion about careers. You know, even at the 9th and 10th grade, when I say to students, what do you want to be when you grow up, there doesn't seem to be a lot of realistic thinking about what's available. So they'll use a study like this to say, you know, well, what do you enjoy doing? You like sitting at a computer playing computer games all day long, not talking to anybody. Well, there's actually a career for you that's very much like that. Or you prefer standing in front of the room, talking to lots of people, trying to convince them that what you're saying is right. Well, there are careers for that, too. So the feedback is these kinds of reports help them, help students figure out a career path if they haven't started thinking about it yet.
Well, moving into another category of jobs, a lot of health and medical care ranked highly in your list. Things like audiologist, dental hygienist, occupational therapist, speech pathologist was up there. Why are those jobs at the top of your list?
Well, you know, you could argue that that's actually part of STEM. I mean, they're all science-related as healthcare jobs. In fact, 9 of the top 10 jobs are essentially STEM jobs. Healthcare has been very strong for the last, you know, many years now. Part of it's the demographics of the country. You have an aging generation. So audiologists who help people with hearing certainly makes sense. occupational therapists who help people regain use of an arm, a hand, a leg, you know, so that they can do their job. Again, an aging demographic plays into that as well. So there's just more need for folks who have these kinds of skills because there's just a limited amount of people who can do it.
And number two on the list, though, is kind of an aberration on the list in that it is not necessarily math-related or STEM-related. It's a tenured professor, so it could be a professor of practically anything. And where have tenured professors been before? Have they always been sort of in the top 10?
They've ranked well, and in fact, we get a lot of feedback from folks. We heard from a tenured philosophy professor who said, you know, I have a wonderful job, I set my own schedule, and every 7 years I get to take off 6 months on sabbatical. So, you know, it truly is a wonderful job. Now, the key is, are you tenured? Because we heard from a lot of non-tenured professors, adjuncts and associates, who said it's a terrible job because they're constantly striving to get tenure, and they have to raise funds for their own projects, and they're not guaranteed they'll even have a job next semester. So being tenured is the key there.
Any other rising stars on the best job list?
You know, anything tied to helping people one-on-one seems to be very popular. I mean, even when I go beyond, you know, the top 10 and look at jobs like dietitian and optometrist and physical therapist, even financial planner, you know, jobs where you're helping others succeed or improve their well-being, those are jobs that tend to be pretty good.
Coming up, we'll get to some of the worst jobs on the list. As we talk to Tony Lee about the best and worst jobs of the year, we'll hear why lumberjacks and broadcasters are very low on this list. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Are you curious where your profession ranks? Maybe you're looking to switch careers. Do you have a question about a certain field? Or do you want to make the case that your job is among the best or your current or past job is among the worst?
We're talking with Tony Lee, publisher of CareerCast, about some of the best and worst jobs of 2014. And we're inviting you to join in the discussion, too, with your questions and comments. And give us some idea of what the best job or the worst job you've ever had is. And do you have it right now? Do you expect to have it a year from now? 800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to join in. 800-642-1234. 1234.
And we'd love to hear your criteria for a good job. What makes a job worth having for you? Is it the pay, the job security, job satisfaction? You name it. 800-642-1234. Call in now. Tony, let's get to some of the jobs that ranked very low on the list. We mentioned lumberjacks. One of our callers called in to say, we don't call them lumberjacks anymore. We call them loggers, by the way. Why do loggers rank so low, Tony?
Well, in other states, they call them lumberjacks.
They do,
Just
it's a Wisconsin thing.
They rank poorly for a number of reasons. I mean, if you go to careercast.com or jobsrated.com, we have our full methodology online, so you can actually read it for yourself. But lumberjacks are paid poorly. Average income's about $24,000 a year. The hiring demand has actually fallen because the demand for paper and paper products has not been great. There's been a lot of automation, so the need for lumberjacks is actually not as great as it used to be due to automation. And it's the job that you will most likely get hurt having. In fact, we interviewed a lumberjack for a previous report who said, you know, I love my job. I'm outdoors. It's great. You know, I don't care if it's 20 degrees or 90 degrees. It's wonderful. And I've only broken my leg twice, and I lost the tip of my pinky finger on my left hand, but it's a great job.
Wow.
You know, how you define a great job is probably different than a lumberjack would.
And speaking of jobs that are in the worst category, if you are in the media right now, and particularly in newspaper reporters, or if you are in the broadcasting field, they ranked very low in the bottom five. And for those of us who are close to that or in that field, it's kind of surprising. But what makes the media job outlook right now such a challenging one?
So the primary reason, I mean, all the same criteria, hiring demand is not good, salaries are low, outlook is poor. In fact, newspaper reporters actually have a negative hiring outlook between now and 2022, meaning there are going to be fewer of them in 8 years than there are today. A lot of that has to do with the change, the technological revolution of what's going on in the newspaper industry. Papers are cutting back. They just simply don't need as many reporters as before. And same is true in consolidation in the broadcast industry. Radio and television stations are being purchased and merged, and the first thing they do is cut back on costs. So when you have new college graduates majoring in journalism who are, frankly, willing to work for nothing or pretty darn close to it, it's tough to make a living and earn the kind of income that traditionally had been paid in those industries.
Well, if you're into broadcasting and you're willing to work to nothing, it's the place to be, I can tell you that. but what about other types of new media? And I'm thinking maybe social media, websites, that sort of thing. Do they fare any better, or are they still sort of insecure enough where there's some questions there?
No, they actually do fare better in the report. They rank higher, and a lot of it has to do with having different skills. So when you develop skills to be able to shoot and edit your own video, manage your social media and create blogs and then manage the traffic and know SEO to be able to get more traffic to what you write, then you're going to get rewarded more.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Beth on the line in South Range. Beth, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say my most favorite job in 40 years is working as a hospice home care nurse.
What was it about that job that was so fulfilling for you?
Well, that was it. It was so fulfilling. I loved my work. It was something I could master, and it just heard so many positive things about every day from my patients and their families and how much they appreciated what I could do to help them. You know, so oftentimes you're in situations where you can't make a big difference, but these were situations where I felt I could make a big difference, and you go into their homes and help them, and they're so appreciative of that.
Beth, thanks for calling, and thanks for doing that work, by the way. Tony, do you hear that a lot from people responding to your story, that sense of fulfillment of having made a difference as being part of what makes a job for an individual a good job?
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, it goes to what we were saying earlier about being in jobs where you can help people one-on-one and see the actual benefit of your work. You know, it's the psychic benefit of the job. So if you're an audiologist helping a child who has hearing problems, you know, suddenly hear again, or you're a speech pathologist helping someone who's had a stroke, you know, learn to be able to speak again, really high psychic benefits, and it makes it for a great job because you feel more rewarded, and in turn, you actually are paid and compensated well for doing it.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Nick is with us from Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. So tell me.
I just wanted to talk about the truck driving industry. I used to drive by the mile, but now I drive by the hour, and I'm making out a lot better getting paid by the hour.
And do you like the job? I mean, is it something that's satisfying, or is it just something
for a paycheck? It's very satisfying to me. I've always loved driving semi.
All right. Well, Nick, thanks so much for that. And tell us a little bit about how truck driving ranks on the scale of things these days, Tony.
A truck driver out of 200 ranks 170. The reason it's low is for the reason you might suspect, and it's interesting to get that comment. I mean, it's low because the pay is not great. Average income is in the 30,000, 35,000 range. You're away from home for long periods of time. You are monitored very carefully. There's now, you know, electrodes on everything that the truck does. So if you're working for a company, they know when you stop. They know when you're going. But the interesting part for all of these jobs, including a lumberjack or a newspaper reporter, is that if it's a job you love, it's a job that, you know, you don't care what the pay is, you don't care what the hiring outlook is, you love doing it and you're going to continue to do it, then you can ignore this report. I mean, the idea is this is a guide looking at the type of criteria that most people think are important in a job. But if you're, you know, for example, firefighters on our 10 worst list and police officers not far off, yet every year we hear from firefighters and police officers who say, you know, I know the pay's not good, and I know that it's very dangerous, but I would do nothing else. You know, this is what I was born to do. Then great. And if he feels that way about being a truck driver, then more power to him.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. A couple lines have opened up for you at 800-642-1234. Tell us why your job is the best or the worst. 800-642-1234. We'll go to Marcy now in Hurley. Marcy, hi.
Hi. I'm not calling to say my job is the best or the worst, first off. I enjoy my job, but lately, friends and I have been having the conversation about when you often go to college for one specific career, and then at some point you decide that you want to move on or you want to do something else. I mean, I guess we were just talking, we don't even know where you would begin from that, because when you're in college, you kind of have this mindset of where you're going, and then when you're in the workforce, it's kind of overwhelming to even start to think where you would even begin.
Marcy, thanks a lot. That's a great question. Tony, somebody who wants to change jobs or has to change jobs, they've trained in one area. What is a starting point to start a whole new second career?
Well, you know, the real key here is it is important to try and do what you enjoy, to try and do what you think you'll love. I just talked to a college student a couple of weeks ago who literally is graduating 2 weeks with a degree in a field that he doesn't really like, and he's trying to figure out what to do. The cool thing is there is something called transferable skills that if there are things that you do well can be transferred to other industries or other functions. So look at those transferable skills. I mean, are they that you're a good writer, that you're a good public speaker, that you're a good problem solver, that you work well within a team? Identify those, and then you can start to look at other jobs that also emphasize those skills to see maybe the other direction you can go. And then, of course, getting more training. You know, it certainly makes sense for a lot of fields where even if you've got a college degree, to go back and study more in a specific field that you want to move into, you know, that's certainly going to ease your path.
All right, great. Thanks for that call, Marcy. And let's move on to Jordan. And Jordan is with us from Oak Creek. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on, I believe that was Nick that was talking about
the truck driver.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I drive semi also, but I'm just getting into the career, and I drive for a company where there's heavy duty physical labor. I mean, it's, you know, each of us lift about a total of 30,000 pounds a day. And like, just the other day, we noticed that 40% of the drivers are receiving spinal cord injuries. And, it's very different than just truck drivers will call it drop and hook, where you just back a truck up to a dock and leave. You know, we have a lot of danger incorporated with our job. So, you know, like even right now driving home, I'm kind of stressing out, boy, am I going to get hurt tomorrow or not? Or, you know, it's kind of like I'm living on life on the edge. Like, I don't know, any moment I could get really hurt, but, you know, it's kind of worth it because the money is good due to the risk.
Jordan, thanks for that insight, because that is a very different tech than what we got from Nick and Tony. When you hear something like that, somebody just starting out his career and already talking, you know, thinking about the stress, thinking about the physical issues that might arise as part of his job, that's something that people ought to be thinking about even when they're young.
Yeah, I mean, the truck driver ranking, you know, 170 out of 200, a lot of the jobs that rank low have physical demands that can take a toll very fast. And even if you're young and healthy and can do the work now, you know, what's it going to mean in 5 or 10 years? So, I think in that situation what you do is, same idea as the transferable skills. You know, if you're a good truck driver and you like truck driving, start to look for an opportunity where you don't have to do the lifting, where you just do the hauling. I can tell you there are huge shortages right now of qualified truck drivers. So that's a good field to be able to move yourself into a position where you don't have to do the physical labor. But the same is true for any job with physical labor. If you find that it's starting to take a toll, start looking now for a change and not after you've already had the surgery or the broken bone.
Jordan, thanks for the call and stay safe. We'll go now to Dan on the line in Rhinelander. Dan, hi.
Hi, hello. Are you there?
We are. What job did you want to talk about?
Thank you for taking my call. I never get on these shows. But the thing is, we were grown up very poor in north central Wisconsin. We did every difficult job that you could find on a farm. We were on a list for hang. You know, calf pen cleaning at the end of the year is probably one of the worst jobs I've ever had to do. But we caught chickens, we caught turkeys. But this is for, you know, the Eagle Scouts or the Scouts to go on trips for fundraising. But the thing I wanted to say is that you can transfer that experience of the worst job into the best job. I worked as a volunteer in the killing fields in Cambodia. And the thing is that there's a dichotomy here that's not expressed. You can carry something of the worst jobs into the best jobs in situations that people would not recognized.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot. Tony, taking what you've learned in a job you didn't like farming, and figuring out how to apply it in a future job or volunteer situation.
Yeah, no, I think the key lesson there is to remember and to learn what you like and what you don't like. Take out a piece of paper and write down the left-hand side all the things you really like about a job, things you want to do. Down the right-hand side, write all the things you just can't stand. You know, you don't want to do certain things anymore. Then you can actually write a job description looking at all the things on that left-hand column, and you've got a target to go after to try and find a job that matches it as closely as you can.
All right, time for a quick call from Tom, who joins us from Dodgeville. Hi.
Hello. I was a wildlife biologist for 30 years, and it was just a dream job. In fact, I know that those jobs are very hard to come by. It's a very, very competitive field, and I know many people with graduate degrees in wildlife biology that sell insurance or do other things because there's just not that number of jobs available. But it was the best of times, but by the time my 30 years were up and I'm retired now, it turned into the worst of times because in our state we had a horrible disease come in on deer, and I was in charge of carcasses, which were treated like toxic waste. And at one point I had a half a dozen semi-trailers filled with dead deer, which were getting maggoty, that I had to handle.
Tom, well, thanks for that insight. And Tony, it's a reminder, though, kind of a graphic one, that jobs change over time, and you need to be kind of conscious of where you're at any given moment in your career.
Yeah, and, you know, all good jobs have their dark sides, and all bad jobs have their positive sides. I think the real key is just, again, to think about what you like to do, whether it's, you know, wildlife biologist or truck driver, and concentrate on looking for the best parts of it. And again, you know, if you go to careercast.com, we have a lot of advice on how to leverage and make the best out of the job you've got. And we actually have open job openings in Wisconsin for every one of these job listings that we've talked about. So if you go onto the site and look, you can see what jobs are available today.
Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
We've been talking about the best and worst jobs of the year with Tony Lee, publisher of CareerCast.com and JobsRated.com. We've got a link to the report, by the way, on our Facebook page, and you can still share your favorite or least favorite job ever on that Central Time Facebook page.